Welcome to Recalculating America. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America and has been named the best small business book in the Independent Press Awards competition. Each Recalculating program is dedicated to helping small business leaders add profits through efficient growth. During every Recalculating program, experts will give listeners useful information about starting or growing their small business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all whom offer you ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Steve Blue is online with us. Steve, welcome to the program.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. As we have as a tradition on Recalculating America, tell us a little bit about yourself and your business and how you got started in your business.
Well, I'm an internationally recognized business transformation expert. I've been at that for, I don't know, a little more than 40 years now, I suppose. And
wow.
What I do is I take small, sleepy little Rust Belt companies and I turn them into high technology high profitability giants, and I've gotten lots of media exposure over the books that I've written and the keynote speeches that I do. You name any major publication or media outlet, from Fox to Wall Street Journal to Innovation Excellence and Industry Week and even Success Magazine, I've kind of been on them all. And I also run a mid-sized manufacturing company. It happens to be in the rail sector, so I'm about as heartland as anybody's ever going to get. And I know you guys started your programming because of upcoming Trump administration changes and helping small to mid-sized businesses, and so I'm like right in your sweet spot.
Yeah. Give us an example of a Rust Belt company that you turned into a technology company. I'm fascinated with what you do.
Well, the best one is the one I'm with right now, because when I got here, it was a great company, but it had metal bending and plastic injection molded products is all it had, and that was quite a few years ago. Fast forward to today, and we are in the safety space, where we make high technology products that save the lives of railroad workers. About a dozen railroad workers every year get killed on the tracks. You see them sometimes when you're going down the road. They're grinding and they can't hear the train that's not even supposed to be there because they're working on the track, and the train bears down on them and kills them. We have a suite of products that are very high tech, multiple sensing devices, neural networks, communication protocols that warn the track worker of the approach of the train, gives them plenty of time to get out of it before it strikes. And we offer cloud-based services with that, information services. And we went from dumb metal and plastic to high technology neural networks.
Are they still continuing to do their steel and plastics in addition to the other stuff?
Yeah, because that's a good question, because that's pretty good business. I mean, patents have long since expired on all those products, and now they tend to be commodities. And we still have pretty good market position on a lot of those. We're number one and number two on most of them. But still, once a product gets to be a commodity, once a commodity, always a commodity, and then you're sort of left with nothing to defend against but price. So we'll keep with those as long as they're profitable and as long as they provide good income stream.
The note that I have is on you and your organization, and more specifically on you, is that you also help companies that are in distress for their own mistakes.
Yes. You can't, actually, it's been 46 years I've been in leadership positions. I hate to admit that. Maybe I started when I was four. Who knows? if you look at the range of experience I've had, I had some really good ones, and I had some, well, they were all good in a sense, but probably the toughest one, spent 7 years in a turnaround. And I learned a whole lot about you know, what's really important to a business. And as an example, cash is king is one of the principles that you learn in a turnaround. You know, you're not looking at strategic planning because you're worried about how to keep the lights on today.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, as a result of that experience, I learned what can be wrong in every department, every division, and every function in the company, and how to fix it. And so, you know, when a company is in need of a turnaround or is in big trouble, I know exactly. You know, give me a week, and I know exactly where to look, and I know exactly what it is, because they don't have a problem that I haven't seen yet, and they don't have a problem that I haven't already solved at least once.
Viral videos and the news stories all over the country about the man who was forcibly removed off of the United feeder flight, and the president of United come out. How badly has that company been damaged?
Well, I'll give you a contrary view. Major media outlets are saying long-term, nothing. Stock price, little, you know, decline for a while, they'll come back up, CEO's going to survive. I don't believe any of that. I think long-term, this is very damaging. Not because of a specific incident, but as a matter of fact, I put a blog out today that will get picked up by probably most of the major outlets that I said, yeah, United Airlines is living in values fantasy land. And I see this all the time. You know, one of the things I teach is the importance of culture and how to, you know, provide and framework positive, productive cultures and so forth. And for the longest time, you know, most CEOs would give me a blank stare when I brought up that word because they think I'm just talking about the beer for lunch and pizza for, you know, mid-afternoon snack crowd. And thanks to Wells Fargo, well, 4 or 5 months ago, and then Uber, and now United, people are starting to finally pay attention to the damaging effects that a negative culture can have. In United's case, it's very interesting because one of their core values is they claim to have to be warm and welcoming. Huh? Now, how can you be warm and welcoming and do what you did to that guy on the plane? And they also claim that one of their core values is that they make decisions on facts and with empathy. Okay. Well, that's horse pucky. Let's face it. Well, and then as soon as the incident happened, Oscar Munoz went right out and started defending his employees. And do you know why he did that? He did it because he drinks the Kool-Aid, and he believes this is what I call bumper sticker values, because they look good in a boardroom wall. He believes that the culture in United is warm and welcoming, and anybody who's ever been on an airplane knows most airline cultures are anything but warm and welcoming. So since he believes that, of course he would go out and defend his employees. So the long-term impact to United or any company that has lives in fantasy land values is this is just what he just saw in one day and one incident, right? Now, if he has a toxic culture, which I believe that he has, how much damage is that toxic culture doing to his business every single day in year in and year out? That's the long-term damage.
Every time you have one of these incidents, the trust level in the service, even though it may be cheaper, people are not going to be willing to put their lives at stake. And I don't know whether you agree with that, but is there a way for a company under that kind of an attack to survive?
I don't think so. I agree with you. Once it gets to that point, you know, you've got a public relations nightmare. Okay, that's not your biggest problem. Your biggest problem is you've got a culture nightmare at your company, and it's dysfunctional. And if it's gotten that bad and the company is as big as Uber is, it's probably too late to save it.
Before you hear this or this or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at valerocleangas.com.
in your view, what can airlines do to bring back some sort of customer service culture to their cultures?
Well, you know, and I fly a lot too, and I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I'm one of those 2 million milers on American Airlines, and I think I have 1 million miles on Delta. Most of my flying is outside of the country because I do business all over the world, and so I agree with you. I don't like it a lot. The problem, no, I don't think they can change any of it now because of two major structural things that you know very well. If you wrote for Industry Week, they don't have much competition, and that's always a bad thing. And secondly, they have superpowers, right? You know yourself that an airline attendant can just throw you right off the airplane. They have like they have federal powers over you, and you're completely powerless. And that aspect, those two aspects, lack of competition and these superpowers, makes them very arrogant. And the third issue is many flight attendants, they hate their jobs, they hate their bosses, they hate the passengers, and it shows. And you, when you put all three of those things together, mix them up and put them in a pot, you got the worst tasting stew you'll ever have. And I don't think they can change all that unless somehow the government regulation, the airline industry, and they allowed them to consolidate and to eliminate competition. And now most of them got, I call these flight attendants, not all of them, but some of them, wombats in the air. They just got horrible attitudes.
Yes. Yes. Dan?
I think that it's important if you're going to have a policy that it's enforced across the company, not discretionary on a local basis. What do you think?
Well, I agree. The other thing is that was that floor walker an airline employee?
Yes.
Okay. Here's the other problem. A good customer-centric employee wouldn't care what the rules are. It's like the legendary story about the FedEx guy who couldn't deliver a package, so he rented a helicopter. You probably remember that from a number of years ago because he was empowered to take care of the customer no matter what the cost. And someone who's customer-centric would have said, you know what, I'm going to take care of that because that's the right thing to do. But obviously this person didn't care because he gave you the answer that, you know, the policy doesn't allow for it.
Right, and we were just starting to talk about how so strong your opinion was about the ability of United to survive. So, what if you were advising the chairman of United? What would you tell him to do?
The chairman, I tell him get rid of the CEO, and I'd get with Congress before Congress, because what Congress is going to do with all this, you know, media coverage, they're going to start looking at slapping on some onerous and unnecessary and expensive regulation on the airlines, and I'm not sure that they shouldn't. I have conflicting feelings about that, but I would definitely get rid of the CEO, and then I would do a huge what I call a values checkup. And I tell CEOs this all the time. You know, you're living in a fantasy land if you think your culture is warm and welcoming when it's not. And so you have a huge problem because culture dominates everything in a company. It drives people's thinking. It drives people's behavior. It drives how they interact with each other. It drives good and bad outcomes. Like Wells Fargo, their culture was really profit no matter what, even though their culture supposedly was, you know, whatever it is, doing what's right for the customer. So all kinds of bad outcomes result from having a toxic culture, including, you know, price fixing and creating ghost accounts like Wells Fargo did. And what United has to do is they have to go layer by layer and figure out what are the values that they really have. I could probably tell them, spending 2 days there, I could tell them what they are. And then they have to start making changes in the leadership, because this stuff usually starts pretty close to the top. It usually doesn't start with the CEO because he's living in a dream world, but it usually doesn't go too far below the CEO where these outcomes are driven by values that their leaders have. I call them leaders, but they're really not. And you have to start making changes one layer at a time until you get to the kind of values that you want your company to have, And then you have to have leaders in place that believe in those values and act out those values. And you have to have policies and programs in place that support those values. I'll just give you a perfect example. Over at Wells Fargo, because it was profit at any cost, they have policies in place that say when you sign up accounts, you get extra little goodies here.
Right.
So therefore, that drives the behavior of people to keep signing up more accounts no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And what they should have is a procedure and a policy that says, I'll give you an example. Lehman Brothers, when they went belly up, they gave a lot of their senior executives on the last year like huge bonuses because they made their goals.
Yeah.
Well, the company went belly up, but you made your goals. You have to have policies and programs that support, teamwork across the organization, whatever the values are. You have to have, like, teamwork's one of the values in my company, right? You can get fired in my company if you aren't a team player, just for that alone. And teamwork is an interesting example because everybody talks teamwork. It's a nice phrase, but few people do it because it's basically not a natural act, because what companies will do, they'll say, we want you to be part of a team, but we're going to incentivize you to act like the Lone Ranger. When you should be incentivizing people to work as a team, right? So you say,
right.
If you meet your goal, you all get the goodies. If you don't meet your goal, I don't care what any individual does, nobody gets it. That's just one example.
Except I want to raise one other issue, which is Uber. Wonderful, conceptually a great business model, destroyed and perhaps destroyed to the point that not only is the company destroyed, but will people trust anybody in this business again? And what would you be telling the people at Uber? We're talking about women who were raped and houses were robbed, much more horrendous than what happened at United. How does that company ever come back?
Well, they have two big issues, and I've taken quite a few Ubers in the last couple of years, and I always ask them, because this is what I do, right? This is I evaluate and I assess and I fix things. So I ask them, how's it going? Nope. Every single Uber driver I talk to hates the company. Now, I haven't talked to every single Uber driver, so I don't know if they all hate the company, but the ones that I've talked to do, and it's basically because they feel like they've been cheated. And one thing, you may know this, you may not, when an Uber driver accepts a ride assignment, he doesn't know where he's going. They won't tell him where he's going, even though the system knows, because, you got to put in what your destination, all that. Won't tell him where they're going because they're afraid they might turn down the ride. And, these guys say, I don't know if I'm going for an hour or if I'm going for 5 minutes or whatever. And it's just a perfect example of how their business model is to, I'm sure they don't express it this way, their business model is to cheat their drivers. And that's how they feel about it. So they have to change that whole business model and make it more bilateral, make it more balanced where, they'll take a little less profit and treat the drivers better. That'd be the first thing I'd get rid of. I'd make sure that the drivers, and then once you do that, now you can start getting better people, right? If you treat people badly and you pay them poorly, you're going to get bad, poorly performing employees, aren't you?
If you want to have a
better performing organization, you got to treat them better and you got to pay them better.
So I'm fascinated by what you're talking about, and I wonder if you could help me better understand in a little more detail. When you say that the drivers that you talk to feels like the company is cheating them, are they able to articulate how they think they're being cheated?
Yeah, most of them bring up the same issue, which is I'm not allowed to know, and they know, but they won't tell me where the ride that I'm about to. I don't have all the information to make a good decision for me about whether I should take this ride or not. And they all bring up the same issue, which is they know where the ride is going, but why won't they tell me?
So you think that that particular issue has caused the company to hire people of questionable behavior And that's and those are the people that are creating the crimes against the passengers. Is that what you're
saying? I wouldn't make that leap. What I'm saying is that's one example of how the company treats their employees. They don't trust their employees to make good decisions about whether they're going to take a ride or not, or they don't trust their employees to make the correct decision for the company about whether to take the ride or not. And that attitude probably permeates every other one of their policies. Now, I don't know what all their policies are. It's not for me to say, but if that's how they treat their employees on one policy point, they probably treat them the same on other policy points, and so then they're creating a culture of mistrust between the organization and the employees. And who's going to join an organization where you're not trusted by the people that you work with? Is that going to attract the best and the brightest? I don't think so. And so they have to change that culture of mistrust. And there's probably some other things, too, to attract better people. Now, I'm not saying that the people that their current policies bring the people who rape and steal and all. I'm just saying that they can't get really top quality people with an attitude like that toward their employees.
My concern is that given what the drivers have done to their passengers, is it basically destroyed this business model for anybody who wants to get into it?
I don't think so. Maybe it should, but I don't think so. I mean, you know, that as deplorable as it was, didn't last in the news cycle very long, and I would doubt that that's changing mass behavior of the consumer market. I just don't think over the long haul. Now, if it continues, stays in the news cycle, they have a big problem. I remember when it first came out, I said, you know, if the driver did it, it's really, really, really bad. And I concluded if the driver didn't do it, it's really, really, really bad just because of the sensationalism of it.
What would you the number one thing you would tell a small business leader he or she should think about in terms of corporate culture?
That's easy, because here's what I tell people all the time, guys. If you want a model in your mind of how your culture should be and what you should strive for, think Cirque du Soleil. Have you guys seen a Cirque du Soleil performance?
Many years ago.
Yes, many, many times, from small scale to large scale. Unbelievable.
There you go. Okay. So if you conceptualize what your culture should be like and you think about that model, Cirque du Soleil, what are they? They are highly trained, highly motivated, enthusiastic, enlightened group of people who come to work every day wanting to do better than they did yesterday, right? Those guys don't come to work and they don't go, oh, I don't feel like catching you today, or I'm not going to really go far out on my performance to make things really spectacular. I'm just going to have like an average day. They don't do that. And CEOs of any company should say to themselves, how do I create a culture around here that motivates, enthuses, and entertains my customers, and is a phenomenal experience for my employees? How do I do that? Well, you know, there's a lot of levers you can pull. You do it by having terrific leaders who are motivators and not managers. You do it with pay practices. You do it with the structure of the organization, with rewards and recognition. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than I have time to go into today, but that is the model that I tell every CEO. And then they go, yeah, well, you know, it can't be that in the business. You know, my employees, yeah, all they want to do is get to the bowling alley. And I say, you know what? If you have a culture where your employees can't wait to get to the bowling alley, then that's your fault. You built that, and you better change it.
What do you think are some of the issues that are percolating out there that concern you in American culture today?
Well, you know, you have to be concerned about, I don't like to get into politics much, but you have to be concerned about the whole narrative and divisiveness in the country today. That's very concerning to me. One of the things that I'm concerned with, and people my age, CEOs that are a little bit on the older side, let's put it that way, they obsess over the so-called millennials. And I don't understand those millennials. They just soon be off and on. They just soon be, you know, vacationing. They're working, all that kind of stuff. And that doesn't concern me, but it should. It is concerning to people that I talk to in senior leader positions, because they don't know how to deal with them. And they want them to be more like baby boomers, and they're not going to be. They're just, and what I advise them to do is to be, you know, understand them, and you need to build your policies and practices and cultures around accommodating them. You know, whether you like it or not, that's just the way it is. So I would say, and then the third thing that I would say, just kind of from a macro scale, is let's assume that Trump is even half successful in, scuttling bad trade deals, you're getting, you know, stopping currency manipulation, all that kind of stuff, building a bazillion-dollar infrastructure, and there's going to be a whole lot of business coming the way of American manufacturers, and I don't think most CEOs are ready for it. I think they're kind of waiting to see what happens, and then they're going to be behind the eight ball. They should be building inventory, creating their marketing campaigns. They ought to be placing some bets right now. I did an interview yesterday where someone said, well, they can't do that. I said, well, sure they can. I said, CEOs get paid to place bets. And some of them work, some of them don't. But I can tell you one thing, if you don't place any bet, you lose every time.
Steve, thank you very much. We've gone past our time. Hopefully we've captured everything on tape. We've been talking with Steve Blue, a fascinating expert on corporate culture.
It's been a pleasure talking to you guys.
Thank you. This is Dan Perkins.
And Don Mazzella.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. Is it time to get a real webmaster? You may find that you wear many different hats in running your business, but if the internet is an important part of your business strategy, then you might want to consider giving that hat to someone else to wear. You can buy some inexpensive internet packages, but they all have limitations. Some small business people get frustrated because of the limitation on formats. They feel like they're trying to put a round peg into a square hole. Check with other small business professionals and ask them, who are you using to run your website? Make some calls, set up some interviews, and tell candidates what you're looking for. Here is the tip of the day. Ask for references before you meet with those people. Check them out and see how they've done. Look at a minimum of 3 candidates if possible. The oldest and the biggest may not be the best fit for you. I'm Dan Perkins from Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
You know, Dan, there are very few people that I tip my hat to, but one of them is Evan Pollan. He says a lot about a lot of different things, but selling professional services is what he knows best, and he's with us today. Evan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on the show today.
So, Evan, Dan Perkins here. Thank you for coming on, and I'm fascinated by your business and your opportunity to talk about selling professional services, and you believe that your concept works with any product. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your company, if you have a website, how people can get in touch with you.
Sure. So, and again, I appreciate the question. I work in a family business. I've been working with my father, Chuck, who was my co-author on the book, Selling Professional Services the Sandler Way. He bought a Sandler training franchise about 24 years ago, and I joined him in business about 16 years ago. And when we started in business, we were working with a lot of traditional sales folks, selling traditional products and services. And about 4 years into the business, One of our clients was a financial advisor, and his biggest client was the managing partner of a law firm who the managing partner thought he was going to retire until he had his law firm practice valued, and he was responsible for generating about 90 to 95% of the business for the law firm, and he was told that his firm wasn't worth anything and wasn't sellable without him. So he was desperate for just about anything, so he was willing to try sales training. So that financial advisor reached out to us, was one of our clients, brought us in, and that was about 22 years ago. That was the first law firm that we worked with. And what we helped their folks with is showing them that there can be a process and a system around business development, helping them to see why business development should be important for them. And what we did was adopt the Sandler principles to professional services. And after we worked with that law firm, we've over the years worked with law firms, accounting firms, engineering firms, architecture firms, actuarial firms, a lot of folks who in their worst nightmare never thought about themselves as salespeople. But if they wanted to start their own practice, if they wanted to make partner, they needed to learn how to develop their own book of business, develop a practice. And that's what we've been helping them with for the last 20-some years.
So let me ask you a personal question, if I might.
Sure, I'm not sure how personal you want to get, but I'll try.
I want to ask what it's like having father and son work together, especially if father founded the business. How has your relationship with your dad changed, or has it?
So my relationship with my dad, and I am very fortunate because we've worked with a lot of family businesses where generations didn't get along and family members didn't get along. It has been an absolutely wonderful relationship. It's been a wonderful experience. Ours is a true family business where my mother works in the business as well. And it's been great. We still get together on the weekends. We still get together for holidays. But there's something about working with family and having a shared drive and a shared mission that has been a really wonderful experience. Now, that being said, there may have been a small transition period the first couple of months as we tried to figure things out. But once we got by that, it's been an absolutely wonderful experience.
So are you looking now at the opposite side of opening? And that is is your dad interested or your mom interested in and extricate themselves from the business and think about retirement, or are they going to work forever?
So my father in his late 60s is down to about a 60-hour week at this point.
Down to a 60-hour week.
So he's normally in the office by about 6:15, 6:30 in the morning. So I don't see him slowing down anytime soon.
Okay.
The one thing that has been really great is because a lot of what we do with our clients is coaching, a lot of individualization, we find that some folks gravitate towards him because of the gray hair and because of the experience. Some of the younger folks gravitate more towards working with me. So we're really able to work with kind of all ends of the population within an organization. And for the more senior folks, have someone who they're more comfortable with. And the folks who, I guess to put it politely, aren't quite as senior, for them to have somebody who they feel like they can relate to a little bit more. And he and I have a great relationship where we're able to share what's going on with our clients, so that we can bring different insights to our engagement as we're helping our clients try to grow their businesses.
Let me ask you a question, then I'll turn it over to Don. Are you finding that, have you put in a succession plan? A lot of small businesses, especially family-owned businesses, as you said, sometimes certain family members are not interested in, and I'll just let you know, Evan, I'm here in Southwest Florida, and we're doing this live, so there's a thunderstorm passing by. So if you hear rumbles, that's what it is. It's not my stomach, it's thunderstorms. So anyway,
okay.
What about succession planning within your own business?
Fortunately, we've been pretty good about eating our own dog food. So we have sat down and we have put a succession plan in place. We're also in a situation where I have a sibling who's very entrepreneurial, but not involved in the business, and we've been able to help each other. But fortunately for us, everyone in the family is on the same page in terms of how things are proceeding, which just makes things a lot easier and takes one distraction away from like, growing our business.
Well, Evan, I'd like to go and talk now about your process. You have some interesting to say and things to say about the process of professional selling professional services. So you have some basics. So tell us some of your thoughts.
Sure. And I think the first premise that we start with is that not everybody is cut out to be a rainmaker and not everybody is cut out to be involved in business development. So when we first start working with the client, when we first start working with a firm, the first thing that we like to do is get a sense from the management team who has any interest in business development. We find that some of our clients are good with everyone but people, and they may be very, very good tacticians but not very good client-facing. So the first thing that we talk to companies and talk to firms about is the fact that not everybody needs to be client-facing. And that if there are some folks who are really good technically but don't really want to get involved in business development, they shouldn't do that because they're going to weaken themselves in two areas. For folks who are interested in business development, the first thing we like to do is evaluate the talent. And there's an online assessment tool that we use. The tool is called the Divine Inventory. It's a company out of Cincinnati, Ohio. But there was one accounting firm that we sat down with last week. They wanted to see who in their firm would be good at business development, who would have the acumen, who would have the willingness and the ambition and drive to do it. We assessed 12 of their folks, and it turned out that only 5 were folks who they should spend time and money investing in for business development. Some of the folks just didn't have enough of the basic skills where they were going to be successful. Some of the folks were very comfortable in what they were doing and had absolutely no interest in business development. And quite frankly, we find the want-to is the most important thing. If somebody's not interested, if they don't want to do it, it doesn't matter what kind of training or coaching you give them. They're not going to put any of it into practice. So once we identify the talent and identify who's interested in getting more involved with business development, from there, we will work with folks in terms of providing some training and some individual coaching. In both the training sessions and the coaching sessions, we're working on 3 things. One is helping folks to put together a plan for business development. We find that some professionals have no idea how much business they want to bring in. Others have this number in their head, but they have no idea what to do to get there. So first, we'll help them develop the plan for business development and help them figure out what kinds of opportunities and how many opportunities they need to be in front of. The next piece we work with them on is how do you qualify an opportunity more effectively, especially with the attorneys and the accountants and the architects and engineers, so that they're not doing a lot of free consulting for someone who's looking to pick their brain but who may not really be interested in utilizing your services. So we teach them the Sandler methodology of qualifying opportunities, so that they're spending time with the real opportunities and not wasting their time with tire kickers. And the last thing, which is most important for the professionals that we work with, is we really work with them on their mindset and how they can move out of their current comfort zone so that they can start doing new things, so that they can build off of their mindset, so that they can get the results that they're looking for. We find that you can give someone the greatest techniques in the world. If they're not willing to move out of their comfort zone and not willing to try those things, that they're not going to be very successful. And then the last piece for all of this is tracking results. So as we're working with clients, we're tracking how many new opportunities they're in front of, how many of those opportunities are developing into business. We find for a lot of large firms, they can do a much better job cross-selling and upselling. So what we want to do is track results to make sure our clients are seeing an increase in business because of the work that we're doing together.
Well, what you just outlined would be good not only for professional services, but for anything. I'm going to ask one more question and then turn it back to Dan. What I found with many professionals is they have a reluctance to ask for the sale. They go through the whole process. Then forgot to ask the one crucial question. Can I have your business? How do you address that?
What we do is really try to have these folks look at themselves as problem solvers and experts. And as they're going through the sales process, really kind of identify what kinds of issues or challenges their prospects have. And if they've identified that they can help someone, basically to go through, I actually taught a class this morning just on this, is to address the issues. And once they're done addressing the issues, just having them ask the person they're meeting with, how comfortable are you with the solutions? And if the prospect is comfortable with the solutions, then asking, where would you like to go here? Or what was the next step? Or would you like my help? Which for those folks is a little bit softer than them feeling like they're giving a direct sales pitch. But at the end of the day, it gives them the same answer. So rather than, again, doing a hard sale or a hard close, which these guys won't do, and it may not be appropriate, it's, you know, do you think we can help you with the problems? Do you want my help? And how would you like to get started? Which leads to that client engagement.
Dan?
Sure, thank you. Evan, we would like to let people know how to get in touch with you. So do you have a website? And give us the title of your book again so people can
read it. The title of the book is Selling Professional Services the Sandler Way, or Nobody Ever Told Me I'd Have to Sell. And you can get the book on Amazon, and there's also a Kindle version of the book. And you can find me at www.training.group.sandler.com. So that's www.trainingresourcegroup.sandler.com.
Is Sandler a specific style or approach, or what does it mean?
Sandler is the methodology that we use, and Sandler is the largest sales and sales management training organization in the world. And Sandler has been around since the 1950s, was started in Baltimore. And right now there are over 200 franchises in North America, and there's about – and Sandler franchises are in about 16 countries around the world. And the Sandler methodology is very much a methodology of a consultative approach to sales and business development that focuses both on prospecting as well as really a good system for qualifying an opportunity and also helping folks with their mindset when it comes to sales. And we've really adopted the Sandler methodology specifically for those professional service firms to soften it up a little bit for those folks. For a lot of traditional salespeople, they may have 40 hours a week where they can prospect. Most of the professional service folks have 3 to 5 hours a week for sales and business development because they're spending the rest of their time servicing their client. So we've modified that in the Sandler approach over the years. Specifically for those professional service firms.
So when you look at your business, and Don pointed out in his last question, do you have people, you need to teach people how to ask for the order. And I did a lot of work on Wall Street training brokers and security salespeople, and asking for the order was more difficult for them to do is that if they were successful in getting an order from a customer, the next step in the process, can you give me 4 names of people who might be interested in what we've just done? And that's really, really tough to do, but it's been my experience, a referral from an existing customer generally works out to be a bigger customer than what they are. So they tend to help you grow your business. What are some of the challenges? We've got about 2 minutes before we have to take a commercial break, but what are some of the challenges that you have run in over the last 15 years that have been, let's say, somewhat difficult for you to address?
So I think that one specific point is a good one. A lot of professionals we find have what I like to affectionately call head trash. it's a belief they have in their head that isn't really true, that keeps them from doing things that might make them more successful. So a lot of times the head trash that professionals will have when it comes to asking for referrals is, I should be thankful for their business. I don't want to put them on the spot by asking for more business. Or they think that I should only be doing their work and they won't want me working on other people's things. Or I don't want to seem desperate for the business. They should know that I do good work and they should just automatically refer me. And before we teach techniques about how to more effectively ask for referrals, because the close rate on a referral is 50% versus, you know, on a cool lead, it could be 8 to 10%. So the first thing that we really have to address with them is getting them out of that mindset that they're desperate or that somebody's going to look at them funny or they're going to come across as weak in terms of asking for referrals. And once we get them over that hurdle, then we can teach them a professional approach to asking for referrals. But until they get over that mental block, they just won't do it.
Evan, we have to stop here a moment for a break from one of our advertisers. Then we'll be right back with Evan Poland on selling professional services.
At Valero, we believe life gets lived between every fill-up. So whether you go down the road on two wheels or four, whether your Wednesday night is spent racing to the grocery store or down a track, and whether you're dropping off the mail, the pizza, the kids, or all of the above, we're here to make sure you're never running on empty. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
Dan Perkins here for Recalculating for Small Business with your tip of the day. Should you belong to a local marketing network? One area of potential business is other small business owners through marketing networks. These groups usually meet once or twice a month for lunch and discussions. Sometimes the group will invite a guest speaker to talk about how they are building their brand. People in different businesses generally go and make up these groups. If you have a computer problem, perhaps one of the members of your group can fix your problem, or at least tell you about somebody they've used to fix their problems. Sometimes members of your group can use your product or services. So here's your Recalculating for Small Business tip of the day. Reach out and ask your fellow business friends if they belong to a marketing group. And if they do, tell them you'd like to go. Shop around and find a group or two that you like. You'll make new friends and maybe find new customers. This is Dan Perkins with your Recalculating Small Business tip of the day.
We're back here with Evan Poland on selling professional services. And Dan, you had another question.
Yeah, just Evan, while we're coming back, give our audience your website again.
Sure. My website is www.trainingresourcegroup.sandler.com. And the book is Selling Professional Services the Sandler Way, or Nobody Ever Told Me I'd Have to Sell, which you can find on Amazon and is available both Amazon and Kindle version. And if you look up the title of the book or Evan Poland on Amazon, you will find the book.
So let's talk about we have a program, obviously, for small business. At what level, either sales or personnel or whatever, should a company, small business, begin to think about hiring you and your firm?
I've got to tell you, our clients range from individual entrepreneurs, where the person who we're working with is doing the sales as well as doing the back-end fulfillment of whatever the services are, all the way up to one of our clients has been one of the big four consulting firms. So really anybody who is looking to grow their business, what we find that one of the biggest mistakes we find that entrepreneurs make is they will spend so much time focusing on their product or their service that they think that the market will just come to them. And one of the things that we tell clients is the earlier that you can focus on sales and marketing, the better off you're going to be. Because if you take too long to get everything else perfect and don't give yourself enough runway to get sales ramped up, that's a business that's not going to be in business very long. So a lot of our most successful clients are solopreneurs and individual entrepreneurs.
Okay. So when you think about the consulting that you do, do you basically, are you on retainer and you work with the client or throughout the process as they begin to grow their business, or are you event driven? What kind of business is your style of business?
So that's a great question. And we are big believers in ongoing reinforcement training over time to help people, to help to provide them skills, rather than do a half day or one day program where they're going to fall back into their natural habits about a week or so after that one day seminar. So for individual clients, we'll work with them for a period of time. And typically when we're working with them, and a lot of our clients are with us for 3 months to a year, we will provide the onboarding with the assessment, group training on a weekly basis, and individual coaching, all as a part of that program. For larger firms, we will customize, and typically we're working with firms for 6 months to a year and sometimes longer after that year. And typically what we're doing is agreeing on what services that we're providing and then having clients pay us a monthly fee. We find that that's a much better approach, so that when a client needs something, they'll pick up the phone and not think that that phone call is going to cost them X amount of dollars. So we'd rather be more holistic and put together a package where they can utilize us on a regular basis than charge them for each individual service that they're using.
So when you think about your style of business, you're both task-oriented but also consultative, in that you encourage people to look at challenges ongoing that might come up and having a core relationship with you. Is that a fair assessment?
That's absolutely a fair assessment. And for a lot of our clients, we will do the tactical, but we will also sometimes help them with the strategic of how do we get more out of our employees? You know, when do we hire? How do we hire? How do we not make the same mistakes we made the last time that we hired? The nice thing is, although we're doing both the strategic and the tactical, because what we're doing is tied to bottom line revenue, folks are able to very easily track and measure whether or not the work that we're providing for them is leading to more revenue for them at the end of the day. And we strongly encourage them to track from day one what the results are, because we know that when our clients are tracking those results, we're going to be there much longer because they'll see the return on investment they're getting. And we like them, because we're driving towards sales and business development, to look at what they're doing with us as more of an investment, because they're typically getting 8 to 10 times the return on investment back versus looking at it as an expense.
You know, in my career on Wall Street, I've developed product and taught sales forces, both captive and then big distribution sales forces, how to sell a particular product. And one of the things that I've always told brokers or salespeople as I travel around the country is that it takes seven visits or contacts to complete a sale. And there are people who say, wait a minute, that can't be. But then they start thinking about how much time and effort and energy they put in establishing the relationship with that client, and they find themselves, wait a minute, you're right. So do you help them establish a discipline of how they approach an ongoing contacts to build a relationship?
Yes, we help them with a very disciplined approach. And the one thing people tell us they really like about what we do that may be a little bit different than others out there is we will spend just as much time with them on how do you get in front of the opportunity as we do what to do once you're in front of the opportunity. A sales system doesn't work if you're not in front of prospects to utilize the system with. So we spend a lot of time on that, on helping them put those processes in place and then tracking them. And then we'll also work with clients because, again, in many, many, many phases of sales, it takes multiple touches to close the sale. One of the things that we'll work on with clients is how to get clear next steps at the end of every interaction so that they can be more systematic about their follow-up, and they can follow up when their client wants to hear from them, not just randomly putting people on blast and following up with them that messages that may not be appropriate at times that may not be appropriate.
Yeah. We got about 2 minutes. Give it to Don.
Oh, I have several questions, Evan. I have a friend who does expert witness work. He's been doing it for over 30 years. And as you may or may not be aware, but that business, that industry is rapidly declining for a variety of reasons. What do you say to someone like that who's in an industry like that? How do you get them to pump up their marketing?
So that's a great question. There's two things I would have them do in tandem. One is to really kind of circle the wagons and go back and look at who their contacts are and make sure that they're reaching out to their contacts on a regular basis to stay in front of opportunities, to find out what's going on in the industry so that they can get the business that's there. At the same time, we would ask them to take a really good look at the marketplace and try to help them figure out how they might be able to pivot what they're doing, their services they're providing, to figure out how that can be useful over the next 12 to 24 to 36 months so that they can start to put together a plan based on where the market's going rather than just clinging onto the edge of a cliff hoping that they can hang on long enough.
Well, one more quick question. People recommend – well, you wrote a book. People recommend writing books now. What do you say to your clients when they say, should I write a book about my expertise?
My response to them is, what is the purpose of the book? And once the book is written, what are you going to do with it? Because if you just write a book and then hope that the marketplace is going to come to you, you're going to spend a lot of time and effort and be really disappointed. So if you're going to do it, understand why you're doing it, what's the purpose, and then how are you going to actively promote the book to get it in front of the people who you want to get it in front of? Because if you just write a book and let it sit there, you're not really going to be able to accomplish much except to say that you've been able to write a book.
I have a lot more questions, but we've run out of time. We want to thank Evan Poland for being with us.
So I really do appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, Evan, we really thank you, and have a good day and a great rest of the year. And we'll be back right after this.
Dan Perkins here for Songs and Stories for Soldiers with your veterans' tip of the day. Did you know that the suicide rate for women vets is 12 times that of their sisters in civilian life? Did you know that 1 in 4 women vets feel uncomfortable about talking to people about their mental health issues? Did you know almost 600,000 women vets in America are suffering from PTSD? It's time to help. It's time for all of us to encourage our sisters, mothers, and wives to get help by contacting their local VA hospital, clinic, or community-based health care center. So if you know a woman vet that is suffering, go to va.gov and find their nearest VA facility. This has been Dan Perkins of Songs and Stories for Soldiers.us with your veterans' tip of the day.
Life. It's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full. Full of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're back, Dan. And normally I'd ask you a question about our guests. But first, I want to mention something. You know, people talk about the advantages and disadvantages of a small business. But unfortunately, my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, died over the weekend after a long bout with cancer. And what impressed me, amongst other things, was how her company, a catalog maker in Minneapolis, kept her on the payroll and allowed her to work whenever she could through this period. And there are not many big companies that would do that. And maybe that's one of the advantages of a small business. But I couldn't let her passing go by without mentioning that. We're getting back down to the end of the program. What do you say? We call it a day today and say goodbye to the audience.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.